So, dealing with children who get wrongfully convicted for something, like I think about all the things that I did as a kid, not knowing, believing the
Yeah,
adults.
you want to be part of the cool crowd, so to speak, right? I think we all want to teach our kids, and I know I've tried to teach my kids the best I could to stay out of those situations and call me. And no matter where you are, what you did to get yourself in that situation, or what's happening, I come, I get you, no questions asked.
And that actually, is a great point because your children, they come from a place of privilege where they have a family. I mean, in certain cases, we're talking about somebody who didn't have a family and was just seeking affection and love from the first person they found.
And I said, no, I'm not going to testify against him. I love him. He's my boyfriend. He loves me. And so the DA basically said, well, if you don't want to be his victim, you can be his co-defendant. And they charged him and me both with murder.
From Lava for Good, this is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Today, Alicia Burns. In August of 2002, 15-year-old Alicia Burns was swimming at a lake in Ohio when a man named Stephen Kaczmarek approached her. He told her he was 21, and the duo quickly formed an intimate relationship. They decided to steal Alicia's foster mother's car and run off together to Las Vegas. However, this whirlwind romance was anything but. Alicia didn't know that Kaczmarek was actually 32 and a convicted sex offender. Very quickly during their trip, Kaczmarek began to force Alicia into selling her body for money, and he was getting increasingly violent with Alicia if she refused. This continued once they got to Vegas. One day in September 2002, Kaczmarek made one of these deals with a man named Pedro Villarreal. Alicia expected this time to be like all the others. She was to have sexual contact with this man, and he would pay Kaczmarek. But unbeknownst to Alicia, Kaczmarek had a plan to forcibly rob the man. When the robbery went horribly wrong, the man, Pedro Villarreal, wound up dead. Kaczmarek and Alicia were eventually charged with his murder. But Alicia says she did not kill Mr. Villarreal, and that she too was a victim.
I was a foster child and I was trafficked when I was 15. My trafficker forced me to participate in a robbery that resulted in a death. And as a result of that, they made me his co-defendant in a murder charge. My name is Alicia Burns. They gave me 10 to life in prison. I served a total of 16 years.
Alicia Burns was born in Cincinnati, Ohio on March 6, 1987. From a young age, her life with her birth family was difficult.
My biological mother was a drug addict and in abusive relationships, and the state took me and my siblings from my mother. And at three, I got adopted by a family who couldn't have children.
But Alicia struggled in her new family. She wanted to find her biological mother and ended up running away from home. Her adoptive parents eventually put her up for adoption again. And at age 11, Alicia wound up in the foster care system. Her experience was not great.
Most people who are preteen and teenage in foster care endure abuse in all kinds of forms, whether it's sexual or physical or emotional or mental. And that's something that's very prominent in the foster care system, sadly. I spent a lot of time running away from foster homes. I went through 36 different placements between the ages of 11 and 15. So I was booted around a lot and just kind of did the foster care system thing before I ended up in prison.
In 2002, Alicia, now a teenager, was longing for something more. One day in August, she was at a lake with one of her foster parents when a man approached her.
He came up to me and started talking to me, and I liked the attention. I told him I was 18, and he told me he was 21.
They were both lying. Alicia was just 15, and the man, Stephen Kaczmarek, was actually 32. But Alicia didn't know or really care.
I think, you know, above and beyond all logic, I yearned for attention and love so much that nothing else mattered, I guess.
She quickly started to build a relationship with Kaczmarek, and eventually he convinced her to leave Ohio and run away with him to Las Vegas to get married.
I fully believed this man was my boyfriend and that he loved me, that he was the only person in the world that loved me and cared about me, because that's what he convinced me of. That's what he made me believe. We're going to spend our lives together, and I'm going to take care of you, and you never have to be in a foster home again. And of course, that was a fantastical notion to a 15-year-old foster child with, you know, obvious trust issues and abandonment issues.
It felt like a whirlwind romance to Alicia, but then things took a turn.
Yeah, it started on the way to Vegas. So we had stolen my foster mother's car and some money from her, and I don't think we even like made it out of the Midwest. We had stopped at a motel, and he was like, hey, we're kind of getting low on cash. You know, there's this guy, he's, you know, a couple doors down, and he just wants to touch you. He's not going to touch you under your clothes. He just wants to touch you like above your clothes, and he's going to give us some money for it. And I'm going to be right there the whole time, and I'm going to make sure nothing happens. And, you know, you can help us right now.
Kaczmarek convinced Alicia that she had to do this to financially contribute to their relationship.
And so I let it happen. And then the next time we were at another motel, and it was, you know, this person just wants to touch you under your clothes, but just for a second. And then the next time it was a blowjob. And then it just really progressed from there. And by the time that I told him no, that I didn't want to, he hit me hard on the side of my face. He hit me hard enough that my ear was ringing, and hard enough that it scared me to not want to tell him no again.
Wow. What were you thinking when that happened?
I was thinking how much I had messed up, because he was yelling at me and he was telling me, you know, by then we were in Las Vegas. And so he was telling me, like, you know, you're out here, you don't know anybody out here. If, you know, if I leave you, you know, these other people are going to get you, and they're going to treat you a lot worse than I do, you know. And I was scared.
Alicia was trapped.
It seemed like a way to receive his praise, to make him happy. Because he was happy that I did what he wanted me to do. And I was happy that now I could get a burger from McDonald's or a hotel room for the night so that I wasn't sleeping outside.
She didn't realize what was really happening, that Kaczmarek was trafficking her for sex.
I guess it's like similar to any like abusive or domestic violence type of situation. It flip-flops, you know, there's those really bad times, and then it's like made up for with this like overabundance of, I appreciate you, I adore you, I love you, you know? And so it's really a manipulative tactic, you know? And that's what I went through with my trafficker.
But she was also still just a kid, and she believed Kaczmarek loved her. And so they eventually reached their destination, Las Vegas.
Let's go to September 25th, 2002.
Okay.
So tell me about that day. How did it start?
We were walking around on Fremont Street, and my trafficker had met like some guy out there that was also from Chicago, where my trafficker was from. And so they were talking and hanging out and laughing.
Alicia says she wandered away and a man approached her, asking if he could buy her a drink. She said all she wanted was a soda from McDonald's.
And so we walked into the McDonald's so he could buy me a Sprite. And he offered me money for sex.
Alicia told Kazmarek, who saw an opportunity. He and the man agreed on a price, and they decided to go back to his apartment. Kazmarek brought along a friend, who to this day is only known as Tommy.
When we got there, they turned on some music, and they were drinking beers, and we were just sitting there, and the gentleman was sitting next to me on the bed, and he kept, like, rubbing on my legs and things like that, and touching my back, and I was getting uncomfortable, and so I, you know, said I had to use the restroom. So I got up and I went to the restroom and I came back out and sat back down. And then my trafficker said that he had to use the restroom as well. And when he got to the bathroom door, he was like, "Whoa, dude, your mirror is broken in the bathroom." And the gentleman was like, "What? What do you mean my mirror's broken?" And so he got up to go look into the bathroom. And when he peeked his head, like, around the corner to the bathroom, my trafficker grabbed him from behind and started choking him. So I was standing there scared and shocked, and I didn't try to stop it. But I remember just standing there like, what the hell is going on?
Alicia had no idea that Kazmarek planned to hurt anyone, but a long struggle ensued, and then the man lost consciousness. Kazmarek told Alicia and Tommy to go grab extension cords to tie him up. By now, Alicia knew better than to disobey Kazmarek.
So I did. I cut the cord off the back of this small, like, box fan, and I handed it to him. And then he was like, "Okay, we need to look around for any valuables."
Kazmarek told them to bag up the valuables so they could pawn them. And then the man started to wake up. So Kazmarek quickly shifted orders.
And he was like, "Well, just do what I did. Just, you know, put your arm around his neck like I did, you know, until he passes out again." And I weighed 89 pounds at the time. So nothing I did physically was going to make a difference for this adult man who's closer, you know, around 200 pounds. And that's when my trafficker came over and choked him unconscious himself. You know, and he was like, just forget it. Just forget it. Just start wiping things down. You know, wipe all of our fingerprints, wipe everything." And he said that the friend had to help him carry him into the bathroom and put him in the bathtub. And I remember at one point I heard noises in the bathroom and my trafficker was saying, you know, "Shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up." And I looked in there and he was punching him, like, inside the bathtub and telling him to shut up. And he looked over and saw me and he said, "Alicia, don't look, don't look." And he pushed the door closed.
Kazmarek then ordered Alicia and Tommy to clean up the apartment and continued to wipe everything down to not leave any fingerprints.
"Because when we leave, I'm going to open, you know, the window here so that people, not the window itself, but like the blinds or curtains or whatever it was." He says, "I'm going to open this so in case people walk by, it looks normal in here."
After they left, Kazmarek pawned the items they stole. Alicia says that when they left, the man in the bathtub was still alive. About a week later, she says Kazmarek was back to trying to solicit Alicia's body for money, this time at the Stardust Casino.
I got stopped by security because I was very clearly underage. And he came over while security was talking to me to kind of try to, I guess, try to talk us out of it or something. And security took his ID as well. And they took us into the back. Apparently the security guard got a fishy feeling about the whole scenario. And the security guard started asking me questions. He wanted to know how old I was, and he wanted to know where I was from and how I knew the gentleman that I, or the man that I was with. And, you know, I told him, oh, he's my boyfriend. And we came out here from Ohio, and we came out here because we're going to get married. And then the security guard called the police, and the police came, and they were asking me all the same questions. And, but they were wanting to know if we had ever had sex and how many times and in what fashion and, you know, things of that sort. So ultimately, they arrested him for kidnapping, 15 counts of sexual assault of a minor, statutory sexual seduction, and I was his victim. And they took him to jail for that.
And because police saw that Alicia was listed as a runaway, she was sent back to Ohio. Meanwhile, they had discovered that Kaczmarek was a convicted sex offender on parole at the time. So in addition to the new charges, the police had another reason to hold him in the county jail. While he was there, other incarcerated people learned what he was in for. And in jails and prisons, child molestation is considered by other prisoners one of the most heinous charges someone could have. And often, child molesters are quickly hurt or killed while inside. Kaczmarek knew this, and allegedly, to avoid being targeted, he was telling people he was actually there for a robbery. To our knowledge, Kaczmarek wasn't aware that his victim, Pedro Villarreal, was dead. He was left tied up, but alive. But by now, police had found his body.
And so I guess he was, like, kind of trying to save his ass, instead of, like, being known as a child molester. He'd rather be known as someone who was, like, robbing someone and, you know, and did this and that. And so he had told other inmates about that, and they called the homicide detectives.
It's not clear whether police connected the pawned items to Kaczmarek before or after he bragged to other prisoners, but the admission nevertheless piqued their interest in him. And now the police and prosecution needed Alicia to testify against Kaczmarek, both as a witness to the murder and as a victim to the child molestation. But she was still caught up in their love story.
And I said, no, I'm not going to testify against him. I love him. He's my boyfriend. He loves me.
This episode is underwritten by AIG, a leading global insurance company. AIG is committed to corporate social responsibility and to making a positive difference in the lives of its employees and in the communities where we work and live. In light of the compelling need for pro bono legal assistance and in recognition of AIG's commitment to criminal and social justice reform, the AIG Pro Bono Program provides free legal services and other support to underrepresented communities and individuals.
So, after all Kaczmarek had put her through, why was Alicia still loyal to him? Well, it's because of something called Stockholm Syndrome.
So Stockholm Syndrome is a type of a trauma bond.
This is Kelly Diane Galloway. She's the president and founder of Project Mona's House, an organization that helps women who come in as victims to be transformed into survivors.
And so the reason why we bring that up and we bring up trauma bonds and Stockholm Syndrome is because a lot of people say, well, obviously they weren't held against their will. They weren't chained. They weren't tied. Nobody had a gun to their head. But human trafficking happens through force, fraud, and coercion. And what ends up happening is you can have a victim who, for some reason, believes the words that the traffickers are saying. Nobody's going to help you. If you run, I'll find you. If you run, I'll kill your family members. There's no place to go. Nobody else loves you. Nobody else will take care of you. I treat you so good. And then they start to develop this morphed view of love, this morphed view of companionship, and this morphed view of support, which is why even when you go into the restoration process of a lot of people who've gone through these forms of trauma, it's hard to convince them that their abuser is not their lover, their abuser is not their friend, their abuser is not their romantic partner, but in fact that they are an abuser.
At this point, Alicia didn't realize how manipulated she had been.
And so when my public defender told the DA that I was refusing to testify, the DA basically said, well, if you don't want to be his victim, you can be his co-defendant. They dropped the charges against him where I was his victim, and they charged him and me both with murder. And I was held for 13 days in the adult jail. And during the course of that 13 days, I was in solitary confinement. I wasn't allowed to talk to anybody, but I was receiving letters from my trafficker. And he was basically telling me how much he loved me and how I had the power to save both of us. And because I was young, if I took the blame, they would only give me a little bit of time, and then they would only give him a little bit of time, and then we would get out around the same time and we could still get married and be together. So he was still very much grooming me and manipulating me in these letters.
And for the record, prisoners are not typically allowed to communicate with one another via letter or phone, let alone be in consistent communication with each other. But for whatever reason, this rule was disregarded. And then, as if the letters were not bad enough, Alicia and Kazmarek were allowed an in-person contact visit.
A week or two after the preliminary hearing, the DA, my trafficker's attorney, and my public defender got together and had the judge sign off on a contact visit between me and my trafficker inside the county jail.
It makes no sense why this would happen, except the district attorney had offered Alicia a deal. 10 to life in exchange for a guilty plea. And Kazmarek wanted her to take it.
I can only speculate as to the reasons why he would agree to talk me into taking their deal. We have presumed that there was a possibility that he was being promised not receiving the death penalty because he had already been found guilty. So we think that he was told if he got me to sign the deal, he would not receive the death penalty.
What was the visit like?
I don't remember. And there are no transcripts. There's no recording, audio or video of that visit. There's nothing.
Was there anyone there with you in there?
I don't remember. I remember him. I remember him sitting in front of me and telling me how much he loved me and how taking their deal was the best thing for me. Shortly after that visit is when I signed their deal.
Alicia pleaded guilty to second-degree murder on April 21st, 2003. She had only just turned 16. Her sentence was handed down in June, and on July 1st, she was sent to the women's prison.
July 1st, 2003 is the day that it became real to me. Up to that day, I kind of thought that it was a scared straight program or that they were going to release me like they did the first time. I didn't understand the severity, but I remember that day when we pulled up to the prison and the van pulls in through one gate, the gate closes behind the van, and then the gate in front opens so the van can pull through. When that first gate was closed behind us,
I broke. I started crying because literally, and it was so weird because through signing the deal and through all the court hearings and through sentencing and through transport to the prison, it didn't seem real to me. But when that gate closed, I was like, oh my God, this is real.
Alicia's first years in prison were rough.
I gave up. I gave up for a long time.
What was giving up like? What does that mean?
Giving up was accepting that
that that was my life. And that was all I was ever going to be. I was going to be an inmate forever. I had nobody, and I was by myself, and I had guards, and I had other inmates telling me that I wasn't shit, that I was never going to be anything else, that's what my life was forever.
After the initial 10 years she was sentenced to, Alicia was released on parole in November of 2013. But she says even though she was now 25, she still felt like a 15-year-old trying to navigate the world. Within 8 months, Alicia found herself back in prison.
Simply because I had no life skills. I didn't know anything about life, you know. And so, of course, I found myself in bad situations immediately. During that 8 months, I had gotten pregnant with my daughter. I ended up having her in prison. I did 2 years on that first violation. I got out again, and I was only out 9 months before I was violated again and sent back. During that 9 months, I got pregnant with my son and ended up having him in prison as well.
Because Alicia was in state custody when she gave birth to her children, they were taken from her. And because she had no family to take them, the state put them up for adoption.
When I lost my kids, I was at a fork. I could either give up on life, on everything, or I could fight. And I decided to fight. So I called an attorney. I called a lawyer. I called Tony Abitangelo. And I told him my situation.
And I had the honor of meeting Alicia Burns about 5 or 6 years ago, and we've been fighting for her case ever since then.
This is Tony Abitangelo. He's an attorney in Las Vegas, and while working on Alicia's case, he's found a few things that stand out, starting with the crime scene. Remember, when Alicia, Kaczmarek, and Tommy left the apartment, Alicia said they wiped down the room for fingerprints and made it look as normal as possible. Alicia also says that Villarreal was alive.
2 days later, approximately, the maintenance man, Thomas Riddle, he said that there was a call from another unit saying, hey, there's a flood here. So Riddle goes to the unit that the victim was eventually found in, and there was a chain on the door.
The chain locking the door from the inside.
This is an agreed upon fact. There's a chain on the door. And we all know you can't put a chain on the door from the outside. You got to be inside, right?
So without a way to get in, Riddle left. When he came back less than an hour later to try again, he found the chain off. So Riddle went in the room.
And that's when he finds the victim, Villarreal, in about 2 inches of bathtub water. So once again, these are not facts the defense is just making up. These are facts that I've been given and we're fighting and arguing about.
Tony says this shows that someone else went into the room after Alicia, Kaczmarek, and Tommy left. According to Riddle, the room was also in disarray.
Also, when the police did come to the scene of a crime, they dusted for fingerprints. They found fingerprints.
But remember, Alicia says that they left without a trace. So whose prints were these? Well, they ran them and couldn't find a match. Not to Alicia, Kaczmarek, Tommy, or anyone else.
Our position is run them. Maybe those people's names will pop up or somebody will be identified or a hit is what it's called, will be associated with the fingerprint. And that will reflect who was in there. And that could help Alicia's claim that he was still alive.
It was at this time that Alicia started to realize the truth about her time with Kaczmarek.
You know, there were lots of things on TV about human trafficking and sex trafficking and what it looks like. And there was more awareness about it. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's what happened to me.
I should have been treated as a victim, because victims should be treated as victims. They should not be criminalized for being victims.
I believe that Alicia is a textbook definition of what a child sex trafficking victim is.
This is Kelly Diane Galloway again. Kelly has been helping Alicia understand exactly what happened to her.
One of the initiatives of Project Mona's House is to help raise awareness about victims of human trafficking who have experienced what we call double victimization, victimized by both a trafficker or Jane or John, and then by the criminal justice systems. And it's so incredibly hard for me to understand, believe, and even conceive the mindset of the prosecutors who brought charges against her, knowing her situation. It is incredibly difficult for me to understand why she's on lifetime parole when she literally was bought and sold for sex at 15 years old.
Do you think back sometimes and I can't believe this happened to me, and how did this happen?
I don't wonder how, because I know how. I was neglected. I felt unloved, and I felt forgotten about. And to have somebody even pretend to notice me and love me meant the world. And it meant that I would have done anything for him. And clearly I did.
Do you feel loved today?
I do. Today, I have friends and family who love me and care about me.
Our position is, hey, 2002, sex trafficking really wasn't much of a thing at that time. Since then, we have laws, whether it's in the federal court system or in the state court system, that view this type of behavior completely different.
Tony and Alicia are currently appealing a decision by the Nevada Supreme Court denying Alicia an evidentiary hearing.
I wish, of course, that we can get the conviction overturned, or at least at minimum, get her off of lifetime supervision for parole. But I'm so proud of her and the progress she's made in her life. She is a very intelligent young woman who, you know, she's doing great. I mean, I'm very proud of her.
While she was in prison, Alicia started training in cosmetology. Her most recent parole in July of 2020 cut that training short, so she never got to complete it. But that didn't deter her goals. Even though she hadn't completed her training, Alicia was able to start a successful beauty business in Tacoma, Washington. Within 6 months, she sold it to a medical spa and moved back to Las Vegas.
The plan was to open up the business down here. I was just about to do that when I found out I was growing a human.
Alicia is thrilled to be expecting her third child. While her son's adoptive parents do allow her to have a relationship with him, her daughter's adoption was closed, so she can't get in touch with her. But with this child on the way, Alicia plans to fully enjoy being a mother at last.
This baby is coming, and I have to create a world, you know, for it to come into.
What do you hope for your child? You know, you have two others, but it was not an ideal, less than ideal parenting situation. You know, now you have a chance to do it over.
I want my child happy and healthy and safe and secure. And I want my child to know that he or she is loved and has people that love them.
Alicia is currently looking for work. If you want to help her with basic living expenses while she builds her new life, go to GoFundMe.com/support Alicia Burns. Hey, y'all. Next week, the Wrongful Conviction team is taking a break, but don't worry. We have something very special planned for you. In our regular slot next Monday, we are featuring episode 1 of the Pulitzer Prize-winning podcast, Suave. which I hosted and produced along with the Futuro Media Group. Suave goes inside the juvenile justice system to tell a story of incarceration, redemption, and the unusual relationship between a journalist and source. I know you'll want to hear it. I have spent years on this project, and we'll be back just the week after with another episode of Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. But in the meantime, please enjoy Suave. Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in our bio to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our executive producers, Jason Flom and Kevin Wordis, as well as our senior producer, Annie Chelsea, researcher Lila Robinson, story editor Sonia Paul, with additional production by Jeff Clyburn and Connor Hall. The music in this production is by three-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrongful Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all three platforms. You can also follow me on both Instagram and Twitter at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.